after another blaze just 2 miles away blackened more than 6 square miles and destroyed at least 3 dozen homes. Farther south, a major fire is burning in the Los Padres National Forest in Monterey County. It has charred nearly 30 square miles. There's a third fire north of Sacramento in Butte County. Thousands of residents had to flee their homes, and roads are closed into Paradise, a town of about 30,000. For NPR News, I'm Steve Julian in Los Angeles.
Rush hour on the country's second largest rail transit system was reduced to a snail's pace in Washington, D.C. this morning. A citywide power outage and an underground fire slowed down the commute, affecting thousands of people. Streetlights at major intersections went dark. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll bring you a story that, in the words of our guest, is one of the strangest capital punishment cases in American history. Our guest is Gilbert King, and we'll be talking about his recent book, The Execution of Willie Francis. And indeed, the story revolves around a black youth named Willie Francis. In 1946, he was sentenced to death for killing his employer, a white pharmacist. He was strapped into an electric chair, and the switch was thrown, but the chair hadn't been set up correctly, and he survived the ordeal. And then the question became, should the state of Louisiana, after a bit of rest, send him back to the chair for a second time? Many people, in hearing about this case, started to wonder whether, in fact, Willie Francis was guilty of this crime. It made headlines across the country. Eventually, the state of Louisiana did succeed in putting Willie Francis to death, but not before his case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Gil about the story and about his book, The Execution of Willie Francis. It's published by Basic Books. It's out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Mr. King, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Very good.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Sure.
Just maybe the way to start out would be to talk a little bit about the setting for the crime and the trial. This was in a town in Louisiana, a place called St. Martinville, where you have been. Tell us about St. Martinville.
Well, St. Martinville is really an interesting place. I don't think that most people's idea of the American South, really, if you looked at St. Martinville, it has nothing in common with the rest of the South. It's a very Catholic place for one reason, and you have a strange mixture of Cajuns who, you know, were kicked out of Canada by the English back in the 1700s and sort of migrated all the way down to the swamps of Louisiana. And then at the same time, you had all these Africans coming over from Senegambia, and they settled there, and their culture was French because of the French rule in Louisiana at the time. And then you had all these people who were fleeing the French Revolution. Well, they heard about Louisiana as well. They came to Louisiana. So this part of southern Louisiana is a very sort of a melting pot for French culture. They all share the same cuisine, the same language, the same religion. And it's, to me, St. Martinville is kind of a city that was lost in time. If you go there now, the pictures of St. Martinville from the 1940s look just the same as it does now because the architecture has all been preserved. The only thing different on the streets are the cars that are going by, but everything else sort of looks like 1940s. So that kind of surprised me when I got down there.
Mm-hmm. This crime took place in the fall of 1944.
Right.
Concerned the murder of a man named Andrew Thomas, who owned the town drugstore. He was murdered in and I'm sure what people thought was a sensational and also frightening way, shot outside of his home in the middle of the night.
Right.
Tell us about the crime and also about the way that people reacted to it.
Well, what happened was Andrew Thomas, this was in November of 1944, he was coming home from a dinner party, and this was probably the safest town in Louisiana at the time. There was really no crime going on there. And Andrew Thomas parked his car in the garage, and just as he was coming out of the garage to go into the house, a figure emerged from the cistern, and gunfire rang out. And apparently 5 bullets were fired from this gun. Only held 5 bullets, by the way, and he was shot dead, and he wasn't discovered till the next morning. He was a very punctual person, so you had the gentleman who owned the grocery store next door thought something was wrong. The first thing he did was call Andrew Thomas's brother, who was the chief of police, and they went over and checked on him, and sure enough found his body there with, you know, bullet holes, and it was unsolved for 9 months. Nobody had any idea who did this. There was no other crimes in the area that sort of led anyone to believe that this was a random serial killer. So you could imagine in St. Martinville at the time, people were very concerned. They had a hard time sleeping at night because they thought a random murderer was out there ready to strike again. And it took police they had no clues, really. The only thing they had to go on was the bullets that were found inside Andrew Thomas's body. And unfortunately, when they were able to find the gun nearby, it belonged to one of the deputy sheriffs. So that led a lot more rumors to be going around. There were rumors that Andrew Thomas was having affairs with women and that possibly this deputy sheriff was involved because he had once threatened Andrew Thomas with a gun. So he was sort of a suspect. But it wasn't until a really random arrest in Texas, 135 miles away, when Willie Francis was arrested by police on a case of mistaken identity. And according to police, he had the wallet of Andrew Thomas in his pocket. Mm-hmm.
So here, the police, they're investigating this. It obviously has the community very shaken. They're investigating it. People are scared. There's all kinds of rumors flying around. So it wasn't until the next summer, in July of the next year, when in Port Arthur, they just stumble across the 16-year-old black boy, Willie Francis, who was found to be in possession of the dead man's wallet. And then under police questioning, and apparently there's no really good record of how this interrogation went, but apparently under police questioning, Willie Francis confessed to killing Andrew Thomas.
Right. Now, this was a strange thing because they didn't keep notes of the confession, but apparently he wrote out in his own free hand, and the way that I looked at the confession note, and the confession note is very strange because Willie, first of all, had a third grade education, and he was also a stutterer, so police immediately thought something's wrong with him. He's guilty. He's stuttering. But that was just his regular way of talking. But once they got a confession out of him, he made a lot of oblique references to the crime that sort of contradicted his next confession. But one of the strangest things he wrote in the confession in Port Arthur, Texas, it sounded like he was answering the police questions, and one of the questions must have been, "Willie, why did you do it?" And Willie wrote, "It was a secret about me and him." Now, these mysterious 8 words were never brought up again. It was never addressed in his trial. It was never addressed in his appeal. I couldn't find any other accounts of, you know, trying to explain and square these 8 weird words that showed up in this confession. And, you know, it was a secret about me and him. And police immediately tried to, when they brought this case to trial, they tried to say this was a random robbery. It was a stick-up gone bad, they said. Willie had tried to rob this pharmacist. But really, they knew each other. Willie admitted to knowing Andrew Thomas. They'd worked together. And so there was sort of this understanding that maybe the people in the town, I mean, you had the victim's brother was the chief of police, maybe they kind of swept this part of it underneath and just made it look like a random killing. Willie confessed. You know, some of the evidence is missing. That's not a problem. The kid confessed. And it took, you know, the jurors only 15 minutes to convict Willie.
Yeah, this was it was an all-white jury. They, as you say, they deliberated for only 15 minutes. Actually, another feature of this trial that's just sort of stunning is that even though the record of the trial is poor, we do know something about what happened. And apparently the prosecution presented its case. Then it was the turn of the defense to present its case, and defense rested without doing anything.
Right. This is why they called this thing a travesty of justice. I mean, the first move, imagine that this murder charge is an automatic death penalty with a guilty verdict. The first move the defense tried to do was to take up a guilty plea. change Willie's plea to guilty. The judge just disallowed it. He said, no, this is a death sentence. You can't plead guilty. So they talked these defense attorneys into going through with the trial. But, you know, as I was going through the minutes of the trial, they didn't make one single objection throughout the length of the trial. They didn't cross-examine any of the witnesses. And then right at the very end, when the prosecution rested, the defense rose and said, we rest too. And even more disturbing is that, you know, normally after a death sentence, there's appeals filed as a matter of just, it's an automatic defense movement. These guys had moved on. Willie missed all opportunities to appeal and never saw his attorneys again. So when he later on got another lawyer to come in, they were unable to argue the facts of the case because Willie had missed all these appeal deadlines.
Yeah. And it seems that while there was this confession and they did have a murder weapon, that there would have been the opportunity for his defense lawyers to at least raise questions that might have created some doubt in the mind of the jury concerning the confession and whether that was real or whether there was perhaps some pressure, something. Certainly there was a question about how it is the murder weapon came into his possession. And then there was also the big question of motive, and they had one, but there was something a little bit unsatisfying. There was a number of things unsatisfying about the whole story that was told about what it is that had happened.
Right. I think it was unsatisfying, and looking over there was definitely reasonable doubt. I mean, the only evidence that was obtained against Willie was based on those confessions that he had written out. Now, if the defense had just come somehow said, listen, you detained this guy illegally, you're supposed to be arrested, and the moment of your arrest, you're supposed to be given public defenders. What was kind of a custom in Louisiana in these parts, and especially with African Americans, they would detain them, so they wouldn't arrest them, so they could keep them in jail for as long as they wanted and not charge them with anything. And by doing that, they didn't have to give him a lawyer. And so, you know, and also you had some pretty shady characters who were interrogating Willie. I mean, one of them, the FBI called the serial killer. He had killed the seven blacks in the town of New Iberia. And this was one of Willie's interrogators. So you could imagine a stuttering 16-year-old kid who's really not allowed any visitors, not allowed an attorney. There's things that could have been said. But I found, like you just mentioned, the most disturbing thing to be that, you know, Willie is going into this trial and he's really got no help whatsoever. They sort of convince him to plead guilty. They convince him to just accept the fact that, you know, we're not going to put on a case. And so by the end of all this, and you had all this reasonable doubt, all this evidence that went missing, the gun and the bullets disappeared completely from evidence. So the only thing they really had was this confession, but for 12 Cajun jurors, that was enough.
Just to introduce our guest, for anyone who might just have recently turned in, we're talking with Gilbert King. He is the author of The Execution of Willie Francis. The subtitle is Race, Murder, and the Search for Justice in the American South. The book is published by Basic Books. It's just recently out. Gilbert King is the author of another book entitled Woman, Child for Sale, The New Slave Trade in the 21st Century. He's also contributed articles to a number of newspapers and magazines, including Washington Post, Playboy, San Diego Union Tribune. He's talking with us this morning by phone, and questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, as you say, he was charged, he was tried. He had defense attorneys sitting there beside him that really didn't put on a defense at all. The jury deliberated for 15 minutes. They returned a verdict of guilty. The next day, he was sentenced to death, and the execution was set for May 3rd, 1946. Tell us about what happened when they put him in the electric chair.
Well, it's interesting because when I found this one document, which took me years to find, actually, but it was Willie, to raise money for his defense, he wrote a pamphlet called My Trip to the Chair. And what's interesting about it is he describes that morning perfectly what went through his mind as he was going to the chair, taking the ride over to the jail. And what ended up happening was they drove him from New Iberia. He was being held in a different jail about 9 miles away because they were concerned that he would be lynched in St. Martinville. And this was a more stately, secure prison facility 9 miles away where they kept him. But on the morning of his scheduled execution, they drove him back, and the sheriff and the deputies there had gotten to like the kid. In fact, I couldn't really find anyone ever said about Willie. He was always kind of this charming, good-natured kid. They all said, doesn't seem like a murderer to me. And as a last favor, what they did, since Willie had grown up in St. Martinville, they drove past his house and sort of gave him a last look at his house on the way to the jail. And Willie appreciated that. He was looking in. They drove by very slowly. He was looking in there trying to see his mother because his mother was sick, but he couldn't see her. And as he's driving through his neighborhood, he's seeing all these baseball fields that he used to play on and the bayou that he used to swim in, and he's having all these thoughts that this is the last time he's ever going to see them. And so they bring him into the jail, and there's quite a crowd there. You know, some of them are showing up in support. You know, they believe that his trial was a sham, but most people are there to see vengeance on a popular town figure. And so they bring him into the jail, and the priest is waiting there, and they're counseling him. And finally, Willie walks over to the chair and tries to sit down. The sheriff says, "What? Not yet," and sort of grabs him by the arm and says, "You know, still got a few more minutes. We're still setting it up." At this point, you had two guys from Angola, the prison guard and the trustee, and they were drinking all morning. They were drinking the night before, inviting people to come to St. Martinville to watch them execute this young black kid. And somehow or another, it's time. It's just afternoon. They bring Willie into the chair. They strap him in. And what was the custom back then, and it was started by another executioner who was not able to be there that day, but the last thing they would say to you would be, "Goodbye, Willie," or "Goodbye, whatever your name was," and then flip the switch. So they put Willie in the chair, they put the mask over his face, and the executioner says, "Goodbye, Willie," and Willie tries to answer him, but he's got this stutter, and his mouth is so dry that he says, I tried to say goodbye too, but I couldn't get it out of my mouth. And then they flip the switch. And then what happened was, and according to all the witnesses in there, he starts shaking and bucking and sort of resisting the storm.
This is meteorologist Ed Kayser with an update. A severe thunderstorm warning remains in effect until noon for southeastern Champaign and northern Douglas counties. The area has been squeezed a little bit. At 11:10 p.m., about 11 minutes ago, radar still detected a severe thunderstorm capable of producing nickel-sized hail and damaging winds in excess of 60 miles per hour, about 4 miles west of Tuscola, moving northeast at 31 miles per hour. If you live in or near Tuscola, Pasotum, Camargo, Villa Grove, Murdoch, Tolono, Longview, Newman, Philo, Broadlands, Sydney, or are along Interstate 57 between mile markers 209 and 226, or Interstate 74 between mile markers 194 and 197, you are in the severe thunderstorm warning and in or near the path of the storm. So repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning remains in effect until noon for southeastern Champaign and northern Douglas counties. Stay tuned to WILL for more weather information.
And when they flipped it off, Willie thought he was dead. And he says this later. He says, "I couldn't believe they started unstrapping me. I couldn't believe they were in such a hurry to get me in the ground." He thought he was dead. And finally, they stand him up, and he realizes he survived. He's not dead. And they bring him back to the cell, and they really don't know what to do with the guy. They immediately call the warden. The warden says, "What? How could this happen?" And the governor just happened to be at the prison. He says, "We'll fix the chair and put him right back in." And that's when they had to check with the attorney general because they didn't really know the proper procedure. What do you do when somebody walks away from the electric chair?
Yeah. And just an incredible, incredible story. Just to explain for people, the chair that they were using, this was a portable electric chair, and that they, I guess, would put it on a truck and take it to the place where they were going to have the execution. And these two guys came along and they set it up. And what happened was they were drunk, and they messed it up. They got it set up wrong so that it didn't work the way that it was supposed to work.
Right, and the thing, it came out later in the affidavits that witnesses had seen them passing a flask as they were hooking up. They were having all sorts of trouble. It was a very hot day, and they had spent the whole night out drinking until early hours. So when they were setting it up, they said, "This is the most disgraceful and inhuman exhibition I have ever seen." So one of the witnesses said that. They could tell these guys were just stumbling with their work. And what happened was the way they had it hooked up was enough to give Willie voltage and to shock him, but not enough to kill him or do any serious damage. So he's just getting repeatedly shocked in this chair from this fatal current, which wasn't fatal. And And nobody knew it at the time. It was only later that when these witnesses came forward that, you know, said, oh, these guys were drunk all morning. And mm-hmm. So it was pretty disturbing. Willie had no idea what was going on.
So the governor said, well, just put him back and fix it and put him back in the chair. Although apparently there were some people who said, now, wait a minute, can we do that? Should we do that? Should we at least give him a day off? And apparently there must have also been some people that said, well, the fact that they put this young man in the electric chair and they turned it on and he didn't die was some kind of a sign that maybe he wasn't guilty.
Right. And then that was the popular sentiment in St. Martinville. I mean, the first thing that the governor just said, fix the chair, it says Willie must be executed until dead. So they said fix the chair and put him right back in. Well, there was a lot of complications because you had that traveling electric chair. They had other executions scheduled, so they couldn't just, you know, fix the chair and put him back in. They had to look at the schedule, and unfortunately for Willie, there was a couple more that week. So they decided that 6 days they could bring it back. So he got a 6-day reprieve. But a problem was in St. Martinville at the time. This word got out. Reporters started showing up. It was called Lucky Willie Francis, the boy who lived. And reporters started showing up and interviewing Willie, and this story made it into the national headlines the next day. And his interview that he gave with the reporters sort of became like a cult sensation. It was picked up by all these newspapers because, you know, he was very eloquent. Even though he was stuttering and even though he had a third-grade education, he was actually very poetic in the way that he spoke. And some of the questions the reporters asked him, they said, Willie, what did it feel like to be in the chair? He said, plumb miserable. And then one of the other answers they said, you know, they said, Willie, what is it like to taste death? And Willie responded literally. He says, like you got a mouthful of cold peanut butter. And he described it as little blue and pink and green speckles like shines in a rooster's tail. And then probably the one thing that sort of everyone sort of refers to when they think about the case is on that, just as hours after he walked away from the electric chair, they asked him, you know, what was death like? And he said, you know, and this is his slow Louisiana drawl, I reckon dying is black. Some folks say it's gold. Some say it's white as hominy grits. I reckon it's black. I ought to know. I've been mighty close. Now, when he said that, that was all over the papers, and Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP, wrote a column the next day. He said, what a miracle that a virtually illiterate boy should think an imagery as deeply moving and beautiful as any contemporary poet. And that just sort of brought people into Willie's case. Thousands of letters started coming into the governor, started coming into the sheriff's office saying, you know, you can't send this kid back. He did his time. He did his part. It's the state of Louisiana that failed, and it would be the wrong thing. The hand of Almighty has stepped in, don't you see? And it became this thing, maybe this kid wasn't guilty. And so it sort of brought this renewed interest into Willie's case.
Yeah. We're about our midpoint here of this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Gilbert King. The book that we're talking about here that tells the story is The Execution of Willie Francis, the subtitle Race, Murder, and the Search for Justice in the American South. It's published by Basic Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So in this interim period, there was the botched execution, then they set another date. Here in the interim, Willie's father, a man named Frederick Francis, went to an attorney there locally, a man named Bertrand DeBlanc, and asked him if he would represent his son, represent Willie. And DeBlanc said, yeah, I'll take on the case. Tell us about him.
Well, this is really interesting because Bertrand DeBlanc turned out to be one of Andrew Thomas's best friends. He was over serving in Germany in World War II when he got the news that one of his best friends was killed. And he said, you know, I was just as shocked as anybody in St. Martinville at the time. Now, when he came back to St. Martinville, he was trying to set up his practice, and he set it up right across from the courthouse, and that's where he lived as well. So
this is meteorologist Ed Kieser with a weather bulletin. The National Weather Service has just issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Coles, northern Cumberland, and southeastern Shelby counties in effect until 12:30 p.m. National Weather Service meteorologists detect a severe thunderstorm capable of producing nickel-sized hail, and that storm is about 7 miles southwest of Neoga. That's also about 9 miles north of Effingham. It's moving to the northeast at 31 miles per hour. This severe thunderstorm warning includes Sigel, Neoga, Toledo, Lerna, Janesville, Mattoon, Charleston, Raritan, Ashmore, Interstate 57 between mile markers 169 and 196, and Interstate 70 between mile markers 121 and 126. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning has now been issued for Coles, Northern Cumberland, and southeastern Shelby counties until 12:30. And we have an update on the severe thunderstorm warning. It remains in effect until noon for southeastern Champaign and now northeastern Douglas counties. As of about 6 or 7 minutes ago, spotters reported a severe thunderstorm capable of producing nickel-sized hail and damaging winds in excess of 60 miles per hour, 5 miles south of Pisodum. That's about 3 miles north of Tuscola, moving northeast at 31 miles per hour. And nickel-sized hail was reported in Tuscola at 11:15 this morning. So if you are in Villa Grove, Murdoch, Tolono, Longview, Philo, Broadlands, Sydney, Homer, Ogden, along Interstate 57 between mile markers 214 and 224, and Interstate 74 between mile markers 194 and 197, you're still in a severe thunderstorm warning until noon. So a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Champaign and northeastern Douglas counties until noon, and a severe thunderstorm warning for Coles, Northern Cumberland, and southeastern Shelby counties until 12:30. And if that's not enough, I can also tell you that we have a new severe thunderstorm watch that's just been issued for most of the eastern parts of our listening area. This watch is in effect until 8 p.m., and the severe thunderstorm watch includes Champaign, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Iroquois, Moultrie, Shelby, and Vermilion counties. There's also a flash flood watch in effect for the entire area through this evening, and a flood warning for urban areas and small streams in Clark County into tomorrow morning. Stay tuned to WILL for the latest weather information.
And the reason that there was these constant rejections is blacks made up about 1% of the voting bloc in Louisiana. They just were not empowered. So there was no real motivation for these, and they turned out to be many Cajuns on the Supreme Court, for them to sort of step in and do what they thought was the right thing. Even though a lot of them did think it was wrong to do this, there was no motivation to do it. So after the Louisiana Supreme Court rejected the claim, they had to go to the Pardons Board, which was a three-man board, and because the governor is not empowered to give clemency. It has to be done through the Pardons Board. The problem, again, for Bertrand de Blanc is that the trial judge is on the Pardons Board, and there was two other Cajuns on this board. So it became very difficult. He had to travel to New Orleans and sort of convince them that, you know, let's not kill Willie Francis, and it was really quite an uphill battle for him.
Mm. And the argument that he was making essentially was that to put him in the chair again a second time constituted cruel and unusual punishment that violated the Louisiana state constitution, and so that they shouldn't do it. It wasn't that he was arguing that they should just let Willie Francis go, but that there should not be the second attempt at execution.
Right. He tried to argue that just, you know, throw him in jail for the rest of his life, but killing a man is wrong. It's morally wrong. And he tried to make the argument that it was double jeopardy, it was cruel and unusual punishment. They tried a lot of different things, but unfortunately the law in Louisiana says, you know, and it's the same thing that still stands today, is that, you know, this was considered an accident. It was through no negligence or anything. So it was an accident through no fault of Louisiana that the chair didn't work, and that did not entitle the petitioner to a reprieve. Now, unfortunately, this was before anybody knew anything about the drunk executioners now, because at that point you could have made a case that there was negligence, but Bertrand didn't know it at the time, and so he couldn't present that. And so they went through all the steps, and all the transcripts show that, you know, Louisiana said they weren't even sure that he got shocked, and that's the case that Louisiana tried to make. They think nothing happened. But from all the witnesses and even the sheriff, they were positive that he had gotten some electrical current enough to hurt him.
Then the last thing that he could do, that de Blanc could do, would be to take this case to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And in fact, the court did agree to hear the case, although in this case, there were two other features that are just make you shake your head about how this story went, where there was miscommunication between the attorneys and the court. Apparently, initially, the word the attorneys got was, no, the court refused to take up the case. And then someone had to call him back and say, no, wait, no, that's not right. The court, in fact, agreed.
This is meteorologist Ed Kieser with another new warning. A severe thunderstorm warning has now been posted for southern Vermilion County in east central Illinois until 12:30. As of a few minutes ago, a severe thunderstorm capable of producing nickel-sized hail is located 5 miles southwest of Fairmount. And that's about, 18 miles southwest of Danville, moving northeast at 21 miles per hour. And locations in the path of the storm include Fairmount, Fithian, Catlin, Oakwood, Westville, Tilton, Danville, and Allerton. Interstate 74 from mile marker 198 to 219 is also in that warning. So repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning now in effect for southern Vermilion County until 12:30. There's also one for northeastern Douglas and southeastern Champaign County until noon. And a separate severe thunderstorm warning is still in effect until 12:30 for Coles, northern Cumberland, and southeastern Shelby counties. We have a severe thunderstorm watch for much of the area and a flash flood watch in effect for the entire area. We'll have more coming up soon.
Bertrand said he recognized he was going to need help, and through one of his friends, they found J. Skelly Wright, who was just a young lawyer who was from New Orleans himself, another Irish Catholic, and so he was up in Washington, and they sort of reached out, and you know, he was a young lawyer just back from the war himself, so this would be the first time he'd ever gone to the Supreme Court, but at least he was allowed to show before the Supreme Court, so he was qualified, and so Bertrand shows up in Washington to take Willie's case before, and he just sort of sits at the table besides J. Skelly Wright, and J. Skelly Wright is the one who presents Willie's case, and he argues double jeopardy and cruel and unusual punishment, and he's sort of grilled by the Supreme Court justices, most specifically Felix Frankfurter, who, you know, very much thought that Louisiana had the right to do whatever it wanted in this case. But, you know, true to its form, the Supreme Court debated on this. They were deadlocked 4-4 on this. They really didn't know where to go with it. And Felix Frankfurter, of all people, had the deciding vote. And he was tortured by this because he was against the death penalty. He firmly believed it was wrong, and he thought it was wrong in this case, but he was a practitioner of judicial restraint. He didn't see where he could say that the state of Louisiana did not have the right to do this. And he was sort of the Oliver Wendell Holmes mode, like if a state's decision didn't make him puke, he wasn't going to overturn it. And in this case, Willie Francis' case did not rise to that level, so he was able to cast the deciding vote against Willie.
It's very, here again, another one of the interesting features of the story is his role, particularly Justice Frankfurter's role, particularly the fact that he was the one that broke the deadlock, and then as a result, the court upholds Louisiana. And at the same time, though, he was conflicted about the capital punishment, and in fact, after having voted the way that he did, then he tried to use whatever influence that he could to get the sentence commuted.
Right. And that's what I sort of struck me as very odd throughout this whole story, is that you had all these people reaching out, trying to save Willie Francis, white and black. It was somehow that Willie had struck this chord with the people. I mean, you had Thurgood Marshall trying to save him. You had, you know, religious figures, movie stars like Burgess Meredith and John Garfield, all trying to save Willie. And then here you have Felix Frankfurter, who in his last moments of Willie's life is actually reaching out trying to save him. He thought what Louisiana was doing was horrible. He thought it was, you know, it would be a blot on Louisiana. It was torture, and he felt it was very wrong. And the only way he really knew to do anything, he would not vote that way. His vote would have saved the life of Willie Francis, but he would not do that. And so what he did was he reached out to an old law school friend of his who was very connected in Louisiana, and he got him to sort of go behind the backs of all the other justices and try somehow to get either the governor or the pardons board to sort of overturn this decision. And that's where he was sort of mired in this intellectual swamp. I mean, he really did have the power to save one life, but he felt that, you know, the law was more important in this case. It was more important than a human life, and so he would not vote that way.
So he was indeed, it went back to Louisiana. The Supreme Court upheld the Supreme Court of Louisiana. He was scheduled for execution, and on May 9th, 1947, so this would have been just a little over a year from the date of the first attempted execution, Willie Francis was indeed put to death.
Right, and the strangest thing is Bertrand de Blanc, 24 hours before Willie is scheduled to go to the chair a second time, that's when he learns of the drunk executioners. And what he does is he flies up to Washington, and him and Skelly Wright get this before the Supreme Court on their last day of session, in an emergency session. And the Supreme Court looks at it, and the Supreme Court finally, after all this, they're finally horrified by these charges, because this really says that there is negligence. And they found this, they said it was the shocking allegations deserve a further look. Unfortunately, a prior case had determined that you had to file this first in Louisiana before it could be brought up to the Supreme Court. So even though they rejected it, they said, this would do express, get this down to Louisiana, file this, and then we can take another look at it. And so finally, Bertrand de Blanc sees the out. Him and Skelly Wright realized the court was telling them that now we will consider the negligence charge, but you have to get this through Louisiana first. And Bertrand goes back down, and he's really going back down to tell Willie the good news that he finally found a way to save him. And Willie just says, that's it. I've had enough. I've been going up and down with this case. It's killing my parents. They're getting old in age. I don't want to do this anymore. He says, I want to die. And Bertrand's kind of shocked by this, the poise and the dignity of this kid facing his death, and he just lets him go to his death. And I think that haunted Bertrand the rest of his life, because he probably could have, at that point, he probably could have saved Willie. And he sort of let Willie's calm determination carry the day, and he allowed Willie to talk him into letting him die. Mm.
So you never got a chance to meet de Blanc, did you?
No, I actually talked to his family. His wife is still alive. Bertrand passed away back in 1992.
So I'm just, it's, I'm sure that you're, in a sense, as a journalist, you're sort of sorry never actually to have had the chance to talk to him personally. Though very clearly, as you say, this was something, he was affected by this case, and it was something that stayed with him long, long time afterwards.
Right. I really wish if there was some, one person you could have a dinner with, because I think really Bertrand knew a lot more about this case, and he must have had conversations with Willie about this, and he was convinced that Willie was guilty. And he defended Willie in a way that sort of just said, look, the facts are not the case. I'm arguing cruel and unusual punishment. I think it's wrong to kill this kid after what he's been through. But he was always convinced that Willie was guilty. And I think that Bertrand probably knew something. There was one conversation I was able to find in some of his notes in his files where, some of the mystery about Andrew Thomas started to come to the surface. And so, the hinting of a prior relationship and what Willie wrote, it was a secret about me and him. Andrew Thomas was, at the time, nobody really knew it at the time, but Andrew Thomas was a homosexual. And there was all this innuendo, like perhaps maybe he and Willie had done something and there was something in there. What else would he be saying when he wrote, it was a secret about me and him? And another, when I found it in the notes, somebody asked him about this, and Bertrand got very quiet and really wouldn't answer specifically until this gentleman pressed and said, what was the secret, Bertrand? What was the secret? And in his notes, Bertrand wrote, it would be interactions, and he wouldn't talk about it any further. He just sort of let it go at that point and didn't elaborate. And I always thought there was something cryptic that was happening in St. Martinville that got covered up, and it sort of made sense that, with Andrew Thomas's brother being the chief of police and this trial with, 12 Cajun jurors, Cajun judge, and even Cajun public defenders, something wasn't right in St. Martinville. And I'm pretty sure Bertrand de Blanc knew, but it was probably too explosive for him to really pursue at the time.
And for his part, Willie Francis never denied his guilt.
He never did, and that's what struck me as strange, because he wouldn't say why he did it. That was very vague. He also would not admit to robbing him. He said, I wasn't after money. It wasn't robbery. And so I thought that was strange. Here's a guy who's admitting to murder, but he's saying, no, I wasn't trying to rob him. It was something else, but he wouldn't talk about it. I just always felt that that was strange, and you know, that was the secret that, you know, Willie and Andrew Thomas took to their graves.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Gilbert King. We're talking about the story that he tells in his recent book, The Execution of Willie Francis, Race, Murder, and the Search for Justice in the American South. It's published by Basic Books. It's just recently out. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So it seems to be the case that he probably was guilty, at least, again, as you say, that Willie himself never denied his guilt, that the attorney who defended him believed that he was guilty, although there was much about this case that seemed open to speculation, motive being one. The other is how it is that this gun, which belonged to one of the town police officers, came into Willie's hands. And apparently one of the stories was, and I guess now I don't remember, was it Willie himself said, well, I stole it out of a police car?
Right. That's what Willie wrote in his confession. I stole it from Mr. Ogies, he wrote down, who was a deputy sheriff. Now, what was very strange is that this deputy sheriff had been known to have it in for Andrew Thomas. So there was a lot of speculation, and even Willie's family said he won't talk about it. They think there's a white person involved, but he will not talk about it out of fear. And a lot of speculation in town was that this deputy possibly put the gun into Willie's hand, or that Willie did allude to having an accomplice. He did mention that, and then he changed his mind later and said he was the only one. So there is that sort of doubt that sort of rose. One of the things I found in doing this research, and this had never come up in any of the transcripts, but I went to Andrew Thomas's house, and there's a woman who lives there now, and she remembered that she bought the house right after Andrew Thomas had, you know, passed away. The family sold it to her father. And she said she remembered very clearly that there were two bullet holes in the side of the garage. And this, her father had told her that was from the murder that happened here a couple of years ago. Well, Willie was shot. Willie claimed to have shot five bullets, and the gun only carried five bullets. So all these bullets were strong enough, according to the coroner's report, to have killed him. So you would have to believe that two of those bullets passed through Andrew Thomas while he was still standing and penetrated the side of the garage. It just seems very strange that if it was a terrible struggle, which is what the police claimed, that he was able to, you know, probably never shot this pistol before, because he probably stole it. If he did steal it, there were five bullets in there. He didn't claim to get any other bullets. So he was able to hit Andrew Thomas five times, two of them while standing that went right through. It's very difficult to square all the ballistic evidence. So some people have speculated that maybe the deputy sheriff was the other one who was at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Initially in the book, you talk about when you first went to the town, St. Martinville, and started asking around. You'd ask people about, you know, what can you tell me about Willie Francis, and people would say who. And it wasn't until perhaps you started to talk with some of the older members of the community that clearly there were people who did in fact remember the case, remember the story, and also apparently felt that justice had not been served.
Right, and I thought that was strange, because that sort of it didn't really line up the way you might think it would, where along color lines, you know, you could see maybe in the black community there would be a conspiracy theory, but really it was across the color line. There was plenty of whites that I found, you know, in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s, who told me that boy didn't kill anybody. That's not what happened. And when you hear these things, it is shocking, because you expect certain conspiracies to fall along those racial lines, and they didn't. And I even whites and blacks, I couldn't find anyone who said a bad word about this kid. They always said, oh, he was just the nicest kid. I could never believe murder. He just didn't seem to strike anyone that way. And, you know, even I did manage to talk to Andrew Thomas's family. And, you know, they told me that Willie's family was highly thought of, as was Willie himself. And so even they sort of, you know, I think they believe Willie did it. But they didn't have any hard feelings. Like, I never heard this was an angry kid. It was only a moment before he exploded. he always, everybody to a person would say, he didn't really strike me as the murdering type. And I know you hear those things in the news today, like he was very quiet and shy, but this kid really had a way of his, I guess the way he appeared in town at the time, even to white people, they just didn't see him capable of murder.
If you engage people in discussion about this, did people offer explanations, alternative explanations for the crime, or was it mostly they're just saying that this was that they didn't really think he did it, or maybe it was not like not the way that the crime was represented, and they didn't go as far as to say, but I'll tell you what I think really did happen.
No, there was a lot of speculation in terms of what I really did think happened, and a lot of that had to do with the deputy sheriff, August Fusier. A lot of people thought that this was a bad man, that this guy would have been the guy. If you were to pick anybody in town who would kill somebody, it would be this guy. You know, he'd gotten into a lot of scrapes. He was a violent person, and then his gun is found at the scene, and he was one who, according to one of the priests, had been known to have threatened Andrew Thomas in his store with a gun once. This was a person I think people saw as likely. So when his name rose to the surface, there was always this rumor that he would have been the one. But I think a lot of people, from what I can understand, and the more I talk to people, the general perception is there's more to this story than you really know. There was sort of interactions, and they alluded to Andrew Thomas being this mysterious bachelor who lived out of town, and that perhaps his connections in the government in St. Martinville enabled this trial to sort of sweep things underneath and sort of make it a little more clean that, yeah, Willie did it. You don't need to know the reason. He's not going to testify, and he admits it. He's not going to talk about it. You could imagine if something did happen, Willie would probably be the way he did act. He didn't really want to talk about motive. He said, I wasn't trying to rob him. I killed him, but that's all I'm going to say. And so I think Willie's family felt the same way, that there was something that was not going to come out, and Willie was too scared to talk about it.
It's really a remarkable story for so many of its features. How was it that you initially got interested in writing about this?
Well, I think, you know, I looked at it as like a curiosity, like, oh, this kid who lived through the electric chair. That was the first thing I looked at, but I didn't know if this was a story or even a book. But at one point, I started looking into it, and I found that confession. And when I saw that confession with the words, you know, it was a secret about me and him, that's when I thought, boy, this is one of those Southern cases that just kind of got quieted up in court, and they were able to effectively manipulate the trial. You know, the defense had the opportunity to request transcripts, and they didn't do that. And that was Willie's defense. And if you were going to appeal something, especially a death penalty case, the first thing you'd want is transcripts, and they decided not to go for those. And so at that point, that's when I sort of went down there and started poking around a little bit and talking to people. And when after, you know, the secret about me and him, when people started alluding to these other possibilities, that's when I thought, this is really a case or a story about this town and how it copes with this murder, and sort of the bond between Bertrand DeBlanc and Willie, I thought was really interesting. Because, you know, the unlikely person of a Cajun whose best friend is murdered coming to Willie's defense and really liking Willie so much, I just thought that was worth a story right there.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is something that, you know, I've read too many books and seen too many movies, but I would wonder whether somebody like you, an outsider coming into this community, perhaps asking questions about something that was not particularly pleasant or flattering that had happened, even though we're talking about something that had happened in the late 1940s, I would think that maybe some people just wouldn't really be that eager to talk about it or to have you around asking questions about it.
You know, I really was nervous about it, too. And you know, I certainly felt like, oh, here's this New York guy who's going down there and sort of opening up old wounds and bringing up names. And you have to remember, people in St. Martinville, their families, I mean, the sheriff in St. Martinville at the time, their family is still there. They've had three generations of sheriffs, so people did not move away. And almost everybody you talk to, they would say, oh, that's my great uncle, or, you know, that was my grandfather on my wife's side. And, you know, there was a connection there. But I think the thing that really surprised me was that Cajuns, I didn't know much about Cajuns when I got down there. They are the warmest, friendliest people I've ever met, and they were more than happy to talk. They would talk about their relatives, sometimes not in the most glowing ways. they would take me around in their trucks and give me tours of St. Martinville and show me all the places. And sort of they were flattered that somebody was actually coming into their town and asking about the history of the town. And even though there were certain areas of it that were uncomfortable, they sort of acknowledged it and said, well, it's the truth. You know, you have to do what you have to do. You have to tell the story. And, you know, I'm not telling you not to do this. Go ahead and do it. It's the town could use a shakeup, they'd say.
Yeah. And it's sort of fascinating to me that these events that took place now, I don't know, how many years ago?
61 years ago.
60 years ago in the late 40s would still have currency, you know, not as if they happened 60 years ago, but maybe as if they had just happened, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, maybe.
Right, and, you know, it's sort of a story of humanity in the face of this inhumanity that's happening, and I tried to really bring to it this story about who Willie Francis was, because he was just this headline kid, lucky Willie Francis, who you know, survived the electric chair. And you're right about it. In fact, today in the news I saw that the Supreme Court handed down a death penalty decision on this lethal injection thing, and they said it's okay for states to use this three-drug cocktail. And what I thought was really interesting was this has just happened, you know, I think within an hour ago. The last time the Supreme Court handled a case that involved a method of cruel and unusual was this case, Willie Francis, 61 years ago. So it is relevant all of a sudden again.
Yeah. So this is Bays v. Rees. They actually there has been a decision?
Right, just happened. I just saw it right before I came on here. 7-2, they said it was okay for the state to proceed.
Well, and that's one of the things, and here we're coming down to the last minute or so left, but indeed, one of the things about this story that perhaps makes it more than an historical footnote, the fact that we are still having this conversation about methods of execution and, indeed, the question, what constitutes cruel and unusual punishment? Because that, in fact, was the question in this case that was just argued before the Supreme Court. I think it was in January, in the early part of January of this year.
Right. And I think it's interesting because, unfortunately, and the history of Supreme Court decisions, they don't really tackle these kind of cruel and unusual arguments very often. They take it on very few times. The first time they did it was a case of a firing squad in Utah. And what's really odd about all these decisions is that the Supreme Court in 1879 said it was okay for Utah to put this Wilkerson gentleman in front of a firing squad. They cleared the way for that to happen. Wilkerson was shot, and he didn't die. He laid around on the ground. They missed his heart. And so he endured this cruel and unusual torture that the Supreme Court said it was not cruel and unusual. The next case came in about 20 years later when they put William Kemmler in the electric chair. Now, New York State wanted to electrocute William Kemmler, and the court finally said, fine, electrocution is not cruel and unusual punishment. Sure enough, they turned the switch on Kemmler, and he doesn't die. He has a botched execution. And then it's always ironic because the Supreme Court decided right before the executions were botched. So it's kind of this strange record of the Supreme Court, which doesn't very well for Mr. Bays.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. The book, it's a good story. The book is The Execution of Willie Francis by our guest Gilbert King. And Mr. King, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates now has 4 area locations, including the Oasis in the lower level of the Illini Union.
It's 2 minutes before 12 noon, and I'm Tom Rogers in for Celeste Quinn for the Afternoon Magazine today. Coming up in the 1 o'clock hour, I'll be talking with author Alex Foge. He is the author of a book called Right of the Dial. It chronicles the rise and slight fall of Clear Channel Communications, which at one point was the largest broadcasting conglomerate in the country, generally in radio. We'll take a look at the career of Clear Channel in the next hour, coming up after our noon hour look at news and business and sports and other things from the BBC and NPR and AM 580. Let's take a very quick look at the commodity markets right now. The Wheat in Kansas City for July is up 19.25 cents at 9.11 and a half. July wheat in Chicago up 33 cents at 8.84. The September $9 even up 32 cents. July corn up 16 cents at the moment at 7.25 a bushel. September at 7.39 up 16.25. December 7.58 up 18.5. July soybeans 15.64 a bushel up 27.5 cents right now. August at 15.56 that's up 18. July bean meal at 4.12.50 that's up 10.30. The bean oil is down 12 at 66.08. The stock market right now, the Dow Industrial Average is at 12,231. That is up 89 points. Let's take a quick look at weather here at WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois, and meteorologist Ed Keezer gives us an update of our weather.
Thanks, Tom. We have two severe thunderstorm warnings in effect right now. One is for northern Cumberland and Coles County until 12:30. That includes the Coles County Airport, Fox Ridge State Park, Charleston, Union Center, Hutton, Fairgrange, Raritan, Bushton, Interstate 57 between mile markers 186 and 190, and Interstate 70 between mile markers 121 and 126. There's still a storm down there capable of producing penny-sized hail.